result, many of them have developed an extraordinary passion for social justice. That passion, which drives some of the changes we are seeing on college campuses in recent years, is our sixth explanatory thread. This chapter is about social justice. We will explore the meaning of this term and embrace one version of it while criticizing another. The term is a lightning rod in the left-right culture war, so this is a good time for us to lay our cards on the table, politically speaking. Greg identifies as a liberal with some sympathy for libertarian perspectives. Before FIRE, he worked for an environmental justice group. He worked for an organization that advocates for refugee rights and protections in Central Europe, and he interned at the ACLU of Northern California. I consider myself a centrist who sides with the Democratic Party on the great majority of issues, but who has learned a lot from the writings of conservative intellectuals from Edmund Burke through Thomas Sowell. Neither of us has ever voted for a Republican for Congress or the presidency. Both of us share most of the desired ends of social justice activism, including full racial equality, an end to sexual harassment and assault, comprehensive gun control, and responsible stewardship of the environment. We both believe that the way social justice is currently being conceptualized and pursued on campus is causing a variety of problems and engendering resistance and resentment for reasons that some of its advocates don't seem to recognize. In this chapter, we describe some of these conceptualizations. We also suggest a way to think about social justice that makes it more likely to be achieved and that harmonizes it with the traditional purpose of the university, the pursuit of truth. What exactly is social justice? There is no widely shared definition. We'll try to draw out its meaning by starting with justice, and then showing in what ways social justice differs conceptually, and in what ways it is the same. Intuitive justice. Justice is arguably the most important moral concept in the history of Western philosophy. From Plato's Republic through John Rawls' A Theory of Justice, philosophers have tried to propose rules and principles that would underlie a fair or just society. Rather than review that history here in order to derive a philosophical definition of justice, we'll take a shortcut and tell you about two major areas of psychological research that, when combined, give us a working definition of people's everyday, ordinary, or intuitive notions of justice. Intuitive justice is the combination of distributive justice, the perception that people are getting what is deserved, and procedural justice, the perception that the process by which things are distributed and rules are enforced is fair and trustworthy. We'll show where claims about social justice fit well with intuitive justice and where they don't. Distributive justice. Sharing plays a big role in the moral lives of children, and they get a lot of practice dividing things equally. If there are 4 kids and 12 jelly beans, each kid should get 3. Obviously. But what do kids do when the jelly beans are a reward for cleaning up the classroom, and one kid did most of the work while another kid did nothing? Even toddlers seem to recognize the importance of proportionality. In one experiment, 2-year-olds showed signs of being surprised when 2 people were rewarded equally if only one of them did any work. By the age of 6, kids show a clear preference for rewarding the hard worker in a group, even if equal pay is an option. At young ages, kids have trouble following this intuition when it means that they themselves get less reward, but by adolescence, they are much better at applying proportionality to themselves. Developmental psychologists Christina Starmans, Mark Sheskin, and Paul Bloom reviewed the research on fairness in children and concluded that humans naturally favor fair distributions, not equal ones. And when fairness and equality clash, people prefer fair inequality over unfair equality. To be clear, sometimes distributive justice calls for equality. For example, Americans seem to have a common intuition that money inherited from a deceased parent should be divided equally among siblings, rather than trying to assess who did more for the parent or who needs the money more. And sometimes distributive justice calls for inequality. For example, when attending to need, particularly within a family or group that has some communal feeling and that thinks it fair and proper to route resources to whoever needs them most. But as the review by Starmans, Sheskin, and Bloom indicates, proportionality or merit is the most common and preferred principle children and adults use for allocating rewards outside a family. Proportionality is the heart of equity theory, the major theory of distributive justice in social psychology. Its core assertion is that when the ratio of outcomes to inputs is equal for all participants, people perceive that to be equitable or fair. We can illustrate the theory with a simple equation. The ratio of your outcomes to your inputs should equal the ratio of, let's say, Mary's outcomes to Mary's inputs, which should equal the ratio of Bob's outcomes to Bob's inputs, etc. The consistent finding in equity theory research is that in most relationships, people keep close track of how much reward each person is reaping, their outcomes, such as pay and perks, in proportion to how much they are contributing, their inputs, such as hours worked and the skills or credentials they bring. They do this more in work relationships and less in intimate relationships, but even in marriages, people are not oblivious to these ratios, and because of the power of self-serving biases, they often have a sense that they are doing more than their fair share of some or all tasks. When everyone perceives that all the proportions are equal, then everyone perceives that things are fair, and harmony is far more likely. When people believe that someone else's ratio is too high, they are likely to feel resentful toward that person, whose rewards are disproportionate to their contributions. They may also feel resentment toward the boss, company, or system that allows such inequities to persist. People are not just being greedy. An early study testing equity theory found that when people were led to believe that they were being overpaid for a job, they worked harder in order to deserve the pay, to get their ratio back into line. Procedural justice. Intuitive justice is not just about how much each person gets. It's also about the process by which decisions about distributions and other matters are made. The social psychologist Tom Tyler is one of the pioneers of research on procedural justice. His central finding is that people are much more willing to accept a decision or action, even one that goes against themselves, when they perceive that the process that led to the decision was fair. There are two basic concerns that people bring to their judgments of procedural justice. The first is how the decision is being made. This includes whether the decision makers are doing their best to be objective and neutral and are therefore trustworthy, or whether they have conflicts of interest, prejudices, or other factors that lead them to be biased in favor of a particular person or outcome. It also includes transparency. Is it clear to all how the process works? The second basic concern is how a person is being treated along the way, which means primarily, are people being treated with dignity? And do they have a voice? Do they get to fully state their case? And are they taken seriously when they do? Tyler's findings are especially important for understanding how people respond to the police. When people perceive that the police are following fair procedures and treating them and people like them with dignity, they're much more willing to support the police, help them to fight crime, and even accept occasionally being stopped and frisked by the police, whom they see as working to keep their neighborhood safe. But if people think that the way the police select people to frisk is racially biased, and that people like them are treated disrespectfully, with hostility, or even worse, with violence, they will understandably be angry and will see the police as the enemy. In a study published in 2002, Tyler and psychologist Yuen Huo found that white and non-white residents of two California cities had similar ideas about what procedural justice entails, but their experiences gave them very different perceptions of how the police treated people. It was this difference that explained racial differences in attitudes toward the police. Combining the two forms of justice, we can say this. Intuitive justice involves perceptions of distributive justice, as given by equity theory, and procedural justice. If you want to motivate people to support a new policy or join a movement in the name of justice, you need to activate in them a clear perception or intuition that someone didn't get what he or she deserved, distributive justice, or that someone was a victim of an unfair process, procedural injustice. If you can't elicit at least one of these feelings, then people are much more likely to be content with the status quo, even if it is one in which some people or groups end up with more resources or more status than others. Proportional procedural social justice. Some conservatives and libertarians have argued that social justice is a useless term. There is only justice, and tacking on the word social adds nothing. We don't agree. We think there are two forms of social justice identifiable in modern political debates across the Western world, one of which is a subset of intuitive justice, and one of which is not. Here's a definition of social justice that accords with intuitive notions of justice from the National Association of Social Workers. Social justice is the view that everyone deserves equal economic, political, and social rights and opportunities. Social workers aim to open the doors of access and opportunity for everyone, particularly those in greatest need. Most Americans would agree that everyone should have equal rights and opportunities, and that doors should be open for everyone. Much of the left-right divide on social policy involves how far the government should go to equalize opportunity for children who are born into unequal circumstances, and whether it is the federal government, state governments, or local governments that should be responsible for that equalization. Using that definition of social justice, we'll define proportional procedural social justice as the effort to find and fix cases where distributive or procedural justice is denied to people because they were born into poverty or belong to a socially disadvantaged category. Some of these cases are extremely obvious. The Jim Crow laws of the American South before 1965 were shockingly explicit violations of procedural justice. Racist police, judges, and legislatures cruelly disregarded the dignity of black Americans and brutally violated their rights. These violations of procedural justice led directly to egregious violations of distributive justice in almost every area of life, including very unequal public expenditures on separate and vastly unequal schools. The Civil Rights Campaign was a long struggle for proportional procedural social justice. Not everyone could see the injustice early on, and many white people were motivated to not see it. This is why common humanity identity politics, which emphasizes an overarching common humanity while calling attention to cases in which people are denied dignity and rights, was ultimately so effective. It did not try to force white Americans to accept a new conception of justice. It tried to help white Americans to see that their country was violating its own conceptions of justice, which had been so nobly expressed by the Founding Fathers, but so imperfectly realized. In our account, proportional procedural social justice falls entirely within the larger domain of intuitive justice. That doesn't mean we should discard the term social justice. Some injustices based on race, gender, or other factors, and their intersections, are obvious. But others are subtle, and people who do not experience them can be unaware of them, as Kimberly Crenshaw noted. It is useful to have specialists within the domain of justice research who focus on this subset of injustices. Furthermore, when such injustices are pointed out, members of the majority group are often motivated to ignore or deny them. It is among the most important requirements of a democratic society that it provide a way for people and groups to make new claims about justice. An open democratic society considers such claims, debates them, and then acts on claims that combine compelling arguments with effective political pressure. If the outcome is new laws that are supported by widely shared new norms, as happened in the civil rights struggle of the 1960s, that's pretty much the definition of moral and social progress in a democracy. To take just one example of a subtle injustice, suppose there is a high school that is composed of 80% white students and 20% black students. The student committee planning the senior prom must decide what songs to play, and at this school, musical tastes tend to vary by race. The committee takes a vote on how to proceed, and the winning plan is to let students nominate a long list of songs, each of which will then be voted on by the entire student body. Democracy is all about voting, right? And the process itself was decided on democratically, so we have procedural fairness, right? Harvard legal scholar Lonnie Guinier explored cases like this in her 1994 book, The Tyranny of the Majority. She pointed out that seemingly fair processes can sometimes lead to a group that is in the minority getting entirely shut out at the end of the process. In the high school example above, it's quite possible that 100% of the songs chosen would be those nominated by the white students. If that example seems trivial to you, just imagine that you're choosing state legislators instead of songs. Guinier suggested some alternative ways that communities could run elections and divide electoral power, ways that would not exclude or disadvantage minorities. Guinier's ideas elicited an angry reaction from some politicians on the right, particularly when she suggested methods that would change the basic system of one person, one vote per seat. She was called a quota queen in the Wall Street Journal. The controversy surrounding her ideas derailed her nomination to become Bill Clinton's Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. But the principle she was elaborating is sound, even if her preferred methods are open to debate. This principle, the need for democracies to protect the rights of minorities, was one of the reasons that the U.S. Constitution's first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, were added so quickly. You don't need a Bill of Rights to protect the rights of the majority in a democracy, because the vote already does that. When social justice is about searching for and ending violations of human or civil rights, particularly when those violations are related to membership in social identity groups, then it is about removing obstacles and creating equality of opportunity. It is exactly what those social workers called for when they defined social justice as the quest to open the doors of access and opportunity for everyone, particularly those in greatest need. Proportional procedural social justice is justice, and justice is never the enemy of truth. Justice requires truth and honesty, and justice is entirely compatible with the purpose, values, and daily life of a university. But what happens when social justice activists focus on a desired end state and pursue that goal in ways that violate either distributive or procedural justice? Equal outcomes social justice. When I taught at the University of Virginia, commonly known as UVA, I sometimes hired members of the UVA men's crew team to do yard work for me. Each fall and spring, young men on the team put flyers in all faculty mailboxes advertising their rent-a-rower service. At least I thought I was hiring members of the UVA men's crew team, but after talking to the rowers, I learned that there is no such thing as the UVA men's crew team. There is only the Virginia Rowing Association. The men who row for the association are all students at the University of Virginia, but the university does not provide funding for their sport. They must each pay more than $1,000 a year to belong to the association, and they are also required to participate in the Rent-A-Rower program in order to raise money for their boats, coaching staff, travel to races, and other expenses. They share a boathouse on the Rivanna Reservoir with the UVA women's rowing team, for which all expenses, including travel, coaching staff, and snacks at the boathouse, are fully funded by the university. Why are UVA students who want to row treated so differently based on their gender? Because the implementation of Title IX was changed over the years. From its original goal of providing equal access to educational opportunities for women and men, the program morphed into one that pushes universities to obtain equal outcomes regardless of inputs. On its face, Title IX is eminently fair and reasonable. It prohibits colleges that accept federal funds from discriminating against women with respect to educational opportunity. In 1979, the Carter administration used an equal opportunity interpretation of Title IX when applying it to college sports. Scholarships were to be available on a substantially proportional basis to the number of male and female participants in the institution's athletic program. Furthermore, the governing principle in this area is that the athletic interests and abilities of male and female students must be equally effectively accommodated. Outcomes, such as scholarships and slots on teams, had to be proportional to inputs, such as interest in participating. Men and women should find it equally easy to obtain a sports-related scholarship or a slot on a team. But in 1996, the Clinton administration began to put pressure on schools to achieve equal outcomes. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights issued a Dear Colleague letter, a general directive regarding Title IX compliance, to all schools receiving federal funding, clarifying how schools could comply with Title IX's relevant obligations. One compliance option was for schools to show that their sports programs, taken altogether, mirrored the gender balance of the overall student body. The letter also offered two other ways to comply, but in practice, if schools chose those options, they were in a compliance gray zone that invited monitoring and possible investigation by the Office for Civil Rights, so hardly any schools did. Furthermore, with the press and various organizations watching closely, schools would be judged by their overall numbers anyway. Schools therefore began to strive for equal outcomes. Some schools cut men's sports teams as part of their effort to improve their gender balance, sometimes citing Title IX as the reason for the cuts. More commonly, schools added women's teams, which is more consistent with the original spirit of Title IX. But that, too, sometimes created unequal treatment. That's what happened at UVA. Before 1994, men's and women's crew had both been club sports. There was no varsity crew program. In its efforts to comply with Title IX, UVA elevated women's crew to a varsity sport, but did not do the same for the men's team. Of course, if male and female students had equal levels of interest in participating in sports, then both versions of social justice would converge on the desired end state of equal outcomes. Give everyone the same access to sports, and your teams will mirror the overall population. Note that equal outcomes in these cases doesn't necessarily mean 50-50. It means representative of the overall student body, which is usually mostly female. Equal outcomes means that of all the students who participate in sports, the ratio of men to women will be the same as the ratio of men to women in the student body as a whole. More generally, equal outcomes social justice activists seem to believe that all institutions and occupations should mirror the overall U.S. population, 50% female, roughly 15% African American, 15% Latino, and so on. Any departure from those numbers means that a group is underrepresented, and underrepresentation is often taken to be direct evidence of systemic bias or injustice. Yet men and women differ in their interests on many things, including sports. A review of the literature led by psychologist Robert Diener of Grand Valley State University in Michigan finds that boys and men show greater interest in playing sports and watching sports than do girls and women. And this is true across cultures, eras, and age groups, whether one uses interview methods or observations of play behavior. Of course, those differences could just reflect a pervasive cross-cultural tendency to steer girls away from sports and deprive them of opportunities. But if that were true, If girls were being discouraged from doing what they wanted to do, then sex differences would be smaller in informal settings, such as when kids are playing in a park, compared with school settings. But in fact, the opposite is true. The gender difference is relatively small in school. Girls constitute about 42% of the athletes on high school teams. But it is much larger when adolescents are observed in public parks or when they are surveyed about how they use their leisure time. The available research suggests that girls and women are often as interested as boys and men in getting physical exercise, but not in playing team sports. If this is true, if boys and men are more interested on average in playing team sports, then universities cannot achieve the equal outcome target just by offering equal opportunity. They must work harder to recruit women and perhaps discourage men. In fact, in order to meet their equal outcomes targets, many universities are resorting to ethically questionable techniques known collectively as roster management, which sometimes border on fraud. As reported in a 2011 New York Times expose, it is very common for schools to pad the rosters of their women's teams with women who never come to practice and sometimes don't even know they are signed up. Some schools invite men to practice with the women and then count the men on the women's team roster. The expose gives the impression that U.S. universities are sneaky and dishonest institutions, but this is the predictable response of a bureaucracy, as we described in the previous chapter. When the federal government pressures universities to achieve equal outcomes in the face of unequal inputs, administrators do what they can to protect the institution. That might require them to violate procedural justice, distributive justice, and honesty along the way. You can see the basic problem if you plug the terms into equity theory. At the University of Virginia, men who want to row must contribute much more than women, $1,000 or more per year, plus renting themselves out for labor. Yet their outcomes are less than those received by women who have a much larger budget. The ratio of men's outcomes to men's inputs is far smaller than the ratio of women's outcomes to women's inputs. Of course, if we look at UVA sports as a whole, the picture looks different. The men's football program is gigantic and costly, and there is no women's football team. The university as a whole is still spending far more money on men's sports than on women's sports, and if you endorse equal outcomes social justice, you'll say that the unequal treatment of rowers is necessary in order to compensate for the money spent on male athletes elsewhere. But when you leave campus, that argument is not going to convince many people. It's very hard to make it intuitively compelling by linking it to equity theory or procedural fairness. Most people want individuals to be treated well, and they recoil from cases where individuals are treated unfairly in order to bring about some kind of group-level equality. This is why quotas generally produce such strong backlash. They mandate a violation of procedural justice. People are treated differently based on their race, sex, or some other factor. And distributive justice. Rewards are not proportional to inputs. To achieve a specific end state of equal outcomes. To be clear, departures from equality sometimes do indicate that some kind of bias or injustice is operating. Some institutions or companies make it harder for members of one group to succeed, as can be seen in recent books and articles about the toxic bro culture of Silicon Valley, which violates the dignity and rights of women, procedural injustice, while denying them the status, promotions, and pay that they deserve based on the quality of their work, distributive injustice. When you see a situation in which some groups are underrepresented, it is an invitation to investigate and find out whether there are obstacles, a hostile climate, or systemic factors that have a disparate impact on members of those groups. But how can you know whether unequal outcomes truly reveal a violation of justice? Correlation does not imply causation. All social scientists know that correlation does not imply causation. If A and B seem to be linked, That is, they change together over time or are found together in a population at levels higher than chance would predict, then it's certainly possible that A caused B, but it's also possible that B caused A, reverse causation. Or that a third variable, C, caused both A and B, and there is no direct relationship between A and B. It's also possible, as we described in Chapter 7, that it's a spurious correlation, that there is no link between A and B, and the correlation is a coincidence. For example, a study of 7,500 German households found that people who had sex more than four times a week earned 3.2% more than people who had sex only once a week. Sexual frequency and paycheck are correlated slightly, but why? What's the causal path? An article about the study that was published at Gawker.com featured this headline, "More buck for your bang. People who have more sex make the most money." The headline suggested that A, sex, causes B, money, which is surely the best causal path to choose if your goal is to entice people to click on your article. But any social scientist presented with that correlation would instantly wonder about reverse causation. Does having more money cause people to have more sex? And would then move on to a third variable explanation, which in this case seems to be the correct one. The Gawker story itself noted that people who are more extroverted have more sex and also make more money. In this case, a third variable, C, extroversion or high sociability, may cause both A, more sex, and B, more money. Social scientists analyze correlations like this constantly, to the great annoyance of friends and family. They are self-appointed conversation referees, throwing a yellow penalty flag when anyone tries to interpret a correlation as evidence of causation. But a funny thing has been happening in recent years on campus. Nowadays, when someone points to an outcome gap and makes the claim, implicitly or explicitly, that the gap itself is evidence of systemic injustice, social scientists often just nod along with everyone else in the room. An outcome gap is a kind of correlation. But if someone quotes from a study or otherwise asserts that one group is overrepresented in a job category or that there is a gap in pay, often the implication is that being a member of one group caused members of that group to be preferentially hired or to be paid more. It would indeed be evidence of improper or illegal discrimination if there were no other reason for the outcome gap aside from group membership. For example, if someone notes that computer programmers at elite tech firms are mostly male, often the implication is that being male caused those employees to be more likely to be hired or promoted, which is obviously unjust if there are no other differences between male and female computer programmers. But are there other differences? Are there other causal pathways? If you suggest an alternative explanation for the gap, others may take you to be saying that the problem is not as severe as the speaker believes it is. And if anyone in the room is displeased by that suggestion, then you may be accused of committing a microaggression, specifically a micro-invalidation. If your alternative hypothesis includes the speculation that there could be differences in some underlying factor, some input that is relevant to the outcome, for example, a sex difference in how much men or women enjoy sports or computer programming, then you may be violating a serious taboo. In an article titled "The Psychology of the Unthinkable," social psychologist Philip Tetlock calls this the use of forbidden base rates. But if this kind of thinking is forbidden, and social scientists don't work as hard to challenge the theories that are politically favored, then institutionalized disconfirmation, the process of challenging and testing ideas, breaks down. If professors and students are hesitant to raise alternative explanations for outcome gaps, then theories about those gaps may harden into orthodoxy. Ideas may be accepted not because they are true, but because the politically dominant group wants them to be true in order to promote its preferred narrative and preferred set of remedies. At that point, Backed by the passion and certainty of activists, flawed academic theories may get carried out of the academy and be applied in high schools, corporations, and other organizations. Unfortunately, when reformers try to intervene in complex institutions using theories that are based on a flawed or incomplete understanding of the causal forces at work, their reform efforts are unlikely to do any good and might even make things worse. College students today are living in an extraordinary time, and many have developed an extraordinary passion for social justice. They are identifying and challenging injustices that have been well documented and unsuccessfully addressed for too long. In the 1960s, students fought for many causes that, from the vantage point of today, were clearly noble causes, including ending the Vietnam War, extending full civil rights to African Americans and others, and protecting the natural environment. Students today are fighting for many causes that we believe are noble, too, including ending racial injustices in the legal system and in encounters with the police, providing equal educational and other opportunities for everyone, regardless of circumstances at birth, and extinguishing cultural habits that encourage or enable sexual harassment and gender inequalities. On these and many other issues, we think student protesters are on the right side of history, and we support their goals. But if activists embrace the equal outcomes form of social justice, if they interpret all deviations from population norms as evidence of systemic bias, then they will get drawn into endless and counterproductive campaigns, even against people who share their goals. Along the way, they will reinforce the bad mental habits that we have described throughout this book. Instead, we urge students to treat deviations from population norms as invitations to investigate further. Is the deviation present in the pipeline or applicant pool for the job? If so, then look at the beginning of the pipeline more than at the end of it, and be willing to entertain the possibility that people of different genders and people from different cultures may have different preferences. Focus as much on procedural justice as on distributive. Are people in all identity groups treated with equal dignity? The answer to that question might be no in an organization that has achieved statistical equality, and it might be yes in an organization in which some groups are underrepresented. Be clear about what end states matter and why. As long as activists keep their eyes on the two components of intuitive justice that all of us carry in our minds, distributive and procedural, they will apply their efforts where they are likely to do the most good, and they will win more widespread support along the way. In sum, 1. Political events in the years from 2012 to 2018 have been as emotionally powerful as any since the late 1960s. Today's college students and student protesters are responding to these events with a powerful commitment to social justice activism. This is our sixth and final explanatory thread. 2. People's ordinary, everyday, intuitive notions of justice include two major types. Distributive justice, the perception that people are getting what is deserved, and procedural justice, the perception that the process by which things are distributed and rules are enforced is fair and trustworthy. 3. The most common way that people think about distributive justice is captured by equity theory, which states that things are perceived to be fair when the ratio of outcomes to inputs is equal for all participants. 4. Procedural justice is about how decisions are being made, and is also about how people are treated along the way as procedures unfold. 5. Social justice is a central concept in campus life today, and it takes a variety of forms. When social justice efforts are fully consistent with both distributive and procedural justice, we call it proportional procedural social justice. Such efforts generally aim to remove barriers to equality of opportunity and also to ensure that everyone is treated with dignity. But when social justice efforts aim to achieve equality of outcomes by group, And when social justice activists are willing to violate distributive or procedural fairness for some individuals along the way, these efforts violate many people's sense of intuitive justice. We call this equal outcomes social justice. 6. Correlation does not imply causation. Yet, in many discussions in universities these days, the correlation of a demographic trait or identity group membership with an outcome gap is taken as evidence that discrimination, structural or individual, caused the outcome gap. Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. But if people can't raise alternative possible causal explanations without eliciting negative consequences, then the community is unlikely to arrive at an accurate understanding of the problem. And without understanding the true nature of a problem, there is little chance of solving it. This concludes part 3 of this book. In these 6 chapters, we showed how the new culture of safetyism that we described in part 1 and the dramatic events that we described in part 2 are the result of many intersecting trends and explanatory threads that all came together in recent years. These threads reach back into history, down into childhood, and out into national politics. Having offered this explanation of how we got here, we now turn to the question of where to go next. Part 4, Wising Up. Chapter 12, Wiser Kids. Something is going badly wrong for American teenagers, as we can see in the statistics on depression, anxiety, and suicide. Something is going very wrong on many college campuses, as we can see in the growth of call-out culture, in the rise in efforts to disinvite or shout down visiting speakers, and in changing norms about speech, including a recent tendency to evaluate speech in terms of safety and danger. This new culture of safetyism and vindictive protectiveness is bad for students and bad for universities. What can we do to change course? In the next chapter, we'll offer suggestions for improving universities. But first, we must look at childhood. In chapters 8 and 9, we showed that there has been a shift, particularly in middle-class and wealthier families, to more intensive and overprotective parenting, and that this is, in part, a response to unrealistic fears of abduction and to somewhat more realistic fears about admission to prestigious universities. We showed that the decline of free play may be part of the reason for children's increased fragility. In this chapter, we draw on earlier chapters to offer advice for raising children who are wiser, stronger, and anti-fragile. Children who will thrive as they become more independent in college and beyond. We are mindful that pathways through childhood vary by nation, decade, social class, and other factors. The suggestions we make here are tailored for American parents who use the concerted cultivation style of parenting that we described in Chapter 8. That's the style that sociologist Annette Leroux found being used by middle-class parents of all races, and that political scientist Robert Putnam said had become the norm by the 1990s for families in the middle class and above. This time-intensive, labor-intensive strategy involves overprotecting, overscheduling, and overparenting children in hopes of giving them an edge in a competitive society that has forgotten the importance of play and the value of unsupervised experience. But even though our advice grows out of our analysis of current trends in the United States, we expect that much of it will be relevant to parents and educators in other countries. South Korean parents, for example, are second to none in their fears about college admissions and their willingness to replace nearly all of their children's free play time with expensive and exhausting test preparation classes. To take another example, British schools can hold their own in any competition with Americans to put safety ahead of common sense. Just as we were finishing this book, the head teacher of an elementary school in East London issued a rule that children must not even touch recently fallen snow, because touching could lead to snowballs. Quote, "The problem is it only takes one student, one piece of grit, One stone in a snowball in an eye with an injury, and we change our view, he explained. That is the epitome of safetyism. If we can prevent one child from getting hurt, we should deprive all children of slightly risky play. We are also mindful that children are complex adaptive systems, as we described in Chapter 1. They are not simple machines. We have shown many examples in this book of well-intended reforms that backfired, beginning with our example of banning peanuts to protect kids from peanut allergies. We therefore offer these suggestions with the caveat that any effort to change one part of children's lives can produce unexpected effects in some other part. More research is needed, but we think these suggestions are likely to be helpful. We hope to start a conversation among parents, educators, and researchers, and we'll track that conversation on our website, thecoddling.com. We organize our advice under six general principles. The first three are the opposites of the great untruths. Principle number one, prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. The first of the three epigraphs that we used at the beginning of this book summarizes the book's most important single piece of advice, prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. That is eternally good advice, but it became even better once the internet came along and part of the road became virtual. It was foolish to think one could clear the road for one's child before the internet. Now it's delusional. To return to the example of peanut allergies, kids need to develop a normal immune response, rather than an allergic response, to the everyday irritations and provocations of life, including life on the internet. You cannot teach anti-fragility directly, but you can give your children the gift of experience. The thousands of experiences they need to become resilient, autonomous adults. The gift begins with the recognition that kids need some unstructured, unsupervised time in order to learn how to judge risks for themselves and practice dealing with things like frustration, boredom, and interpersonal conflict. The most important thing they can do with that time is to play, especially in free play outdoors with other kids. In some situations, there may need to be an adult nearby for children's physical safety, but that adult should not intervene in general disputes and arguments. In that spirit, here are some specific suggestions for parents, teachers, and all who care for children. Suggestion A. Assume that your kids are more capable this month than they were last month. Each month, ask them what tasks or challenges they think they can do on their own, such as walking to a store a few blocks away, making their own breakfast, or starting a dog walking business. Resist the urge to jump in and help them when they're struggling to do things and seem to be doing them the wrong way. Trial and error is a slower but usually better teacher than direct instruction. Suggestion B. Let your kids take more small risks and let them learn from getting some bumps and bruises. Children need opportunities to dose themselves with risk, as Peter Gray noted. My kids love the junkyard playground on Governor's Island in New York City. It lets children play with construction materials, including scrap lumber, hammers, and nails, after the parents sign a long liability waiver. On our first visit, I watched from outside the fence as two 10-year-old boys pounded nails into lumber. One of the boys accidentally hit his thumb with the hammer. The boy winced, shook his hand out, and went right back to pounding nails. This happened twice and did not deter the boy. He learned how to hammer nails. Suggestion C. Learn about Lenore Skenazy's free-range kids movement and incorporate her lessons into your family's life. Remember the first grade readiness checklist from 1979 that asked whether your 6-year-old can travel alone in the neighborhood 4 to 8 blocks to store, school, playground, or to a friend's home? Start letting your kids walk places and play outside as soon as you think they are able. Send them out with siblings or friends. Tell them it's okay to talk to strangers and ask for help or directions. Just never go off with a stranger. Remember that the crime rate is back down to where it was in the early 1960s. Suggestion D. visit letgrow.org, the website for an organization that Skenazy co-founded with me, Peter Gray, and investor philanthropist Daniel Shookman. The site will keep you up to date on research, news, and ideas for giving your kids a childhood that will lead to resilience. One of our simplest ideas? Print out a Let Grow license, like the one I'm about to read to you. Then send your kids out into your neighborhood with less fear that they will be detained by busybodies who might call 911. Here's what the license says. I am a Let Grow kid. Hi, my name is fill in the blank. I am not lost or neglected. I have been taught how to cross the street. I know never to go off with strangers, but I can talk to them, including you. The state allows parents to decide at what age their child can do some things independently. Mine believe it is safe, healthy, and fun for me to explore my neighborhood. If you do not believe me, please call or text them at the numbers below. If you still think it is inappropriate or illegal for me to be on my own, please read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Remember your own childhood. Were you under adult supervision at every moment? Today's crime rate is back to what it was in 1963, so it's safer to play outside now than when you were my age. Finally, visit the website letgrow.org. And then there are spaces where the parent can put his or her name, signature, and two phone numbers. Suggestion E. Encourage your children to walk or ride bicycles to and from school at the earliest ages possible, consistent with local circumstances of distance, traffic, and crime. Ask your school to provide a way for kids to check in and check out so parents can keep track of children who travel to school independently without having to give them a smartphone to track them directly. Suggestion F. Help your kids find a community of kids in the neighborhood who come from families that share your commitment to avoid overprotection. Find ways for kids to get together in nearby parks or in specific backyards. You'll need to work out boundaries and guidelines with other parents to be sure that the kids are safe from major physical risks, that they know to stick together and help one another, and that they know what to do when someone gets hurt. Kids are likely to develop more maturity and resilience in such groups than in supervised playdates or adult-organized activities. Suggestion G. Send your children to an overnight summer camp in the woods for a few weeks without devices. Erica Christakis says, "The old-fashioned generalist camps are where we see the most impact in terms of letting children develop their own interests, where kids can make choices about what they do and don't do." YMCA overnight summer camps often fit this description, but even some narrower, interest-driven summer camps do, too, and many offer scholarships. The key, according to Christakis, is for children to be free of adult guidance or concerns about skill building. Let them play and do things because they are interested, while practicing the art of association that de Tocqueville remarked on in 1835. Suggestion H. Encourage your children to engage in a lot of productive disagreement. As psychologist Adam Grant notes, the most creative people grew up in homes full of arguments, yet few parents today teach their children how to argue productively. Instead, as Grant notes, we stop siblings from quarreling and we have our own arguments behind closed doors. But learning how to give and take criticism without being hurt is an essential life skill. When serious thinkers respect someone, they are willing to engage them in a thoughtful argument. Grant offers the following four rules for productive disagreement. 1. Frame it as a debate rather than a conflict. 2. Argue as if you're right, but listen as if you're wrong, and be willing to change your mind. 3. Make the most respectful interpretation of the other person's perspective. 4. Acknowledge where you agree with your critics and what you've learned from them. Principle number 2. Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your own thoughts unguarded. Children, like adults, are prone to emotional reasoning. They need to learn cognitive and social skills that will temper emotional reasoning and guide them to respond more productively to life's provocations. especially now that the internet guarantees that they will have to deal with trash all along the road of life, it is vital that they learn to notice and manage their emotional reactions and choose how to respond. The second epigraph at the start of this book came from Buddha. Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your own thoughts unguarded, but once mastered, no one can help you as much, not even your father or your mother. Our advice is based on this insight. Suggestion A. Teach children the basics of CBT. CBT stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, but in many ways it's really just cognitive behavioral techniques, because the intellectual habits it teaches are good for everyone. Parents can teach children the basics of CBT at any age, starting with something as simple as getting in the habit of letting children watch parents talk back to their own exaggerated thoughts. A technique Greg learned involves practicing hearing his anxious and doom-saying automatic thoughts as if they are being said in funny voices like Elmer Fudd's or Daffy Duck's. It may sound silly, but it can quickly turn an anxious or upsetting moment into a humorous one. Greg and his wife, Michelle, practiced this with their 2-year-old as a way of calming everyone down during moments of stress. Dr. Robert Leahy, the director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy, suggests that when children are upset and may be subject to cognitive distortions, parents can walk their children through the following exercise. Let's take this thought that you have and ask some questions about it. Sometimes we have a thought about someone, and we think we are absolutely right. But then this way of thinking makes us upset and makes us angry or sad. Thoughts are not always true. I might be thinking it's raining outside, but then I go outside and it's not raining. We have to find out what the facts are, don't we? Sometimes we look at things like we are looking through a dark lens and everything seems dark. Let's try putting on different glasses. Parents can get an accessible overview of CBT from reading Dr. Leahy's book, The Worry Cure. Also, Freeing Your Child from Anxiety by Tamar Chansky is recommended by the Beck Institute, which is another great resource for cognitive behavioral therapy. There are many books, blogs, curricula, and even cell phone apps for practicing CBT. 2 apps that are rated highly by the Anxiety and Depression Association of America are CPT Coach, for those who are in active treatment with a therapist, and Anxiety Coach. Suggestion B. Teach children mindfulness. According to Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. Research indicates that establishing a mindfulness practice reduces anxiety, diminishes stress reactivity, enhances coping, benefits attention, increases compassion and self-compassion, and strengthens emotion regulation. Researchers see improvements in children's in-school behavior, test anxiety, perspective-taking, social skills, empathy, and even grades. Children and teens who engage in mindfulness practice are better able to calm themselves and be more present. For more information and some easy mindfulness exercises for parents and children, see the New York Times Mindfulness for Children Guide by David Gellis, and Cognitively Based Compassion Training from the Emory-Tibet Partnership. Principle number 3. The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. The third epigraph at the start of this book came from the Gulag Archipelago, the memoir of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a Russian dissident of the Soviet era. In 1945, Solzhenitsyn criticized Joseph Stalin in private letters sent to a friend. He was arrested and sentenced to hard labor in the network of gulags, prison camps, spread out across Siberia, in which many inmates froze, starved, or were beaten to death. Solzhenitsyn was eventually released and exiled. In one moving passage, describing a time soon after his arrest, he is being marched for days with a few other men. He reflects upon his own virtue, his unselfish dedication to the motherland, when it occurs to him that he himself had nearly joined the security service, the NKVD, which evolved into the KGB. He realizes that he could just as easily have become the executioner rather than the condemned man marching off to his possible execution. He then warns his readers to beware of the untruth of us versus them. If only it were so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. How can we raise wiser children who will